Magic.
And the world of illusion.
Magic TV.
And Craig Petty. Proudly present the Talk Magic Podcast. Every week we bring you awesome interviews with the greatest magicians that have ever lived. And now, here's your host, Craig Petty.
My name's Craig. It is 9 o'clock, which means it's time for a Talk Magic. And I'm here today with somebody who is just as exceptional with the business side of entertainment as he is the entertainment side of entertainment. He has had a stellar career in both magic and hypnotism, but he's also running many other successful businesses as well. He's literally walked the walk, talk the talk, done more than most performers could ever hope to achieve in their career, and he's only just got started. He's also a super nice guy. I am, of course, talking about the one and only Rob Temple. How you doing, Rob?
I'm really good. That was a lovely introduction.
It's all true.
I can't wait to find out what I'm going to say.
But it's true. I mean, you have done so much. You know, I mean, I've known you for quite a while now, you know, and we've known each other for a fair bit now, and it's just staggering to see how much you achieve. And it's almost like you've got the you've almost got like the golden touch. Everything that you do becomes a huge success, whether it's touring, whether it's yourself as a performer, whether it's your marketing, the business side of things that you do, all your other businesses. You always have that golden touch. And it's not luck. And that's hopefully one thing that we can dive into on this podcast. On this interview, it's not just luck. You know what you're doing, and you have a kind of a goal, don't you? And you kind of just go head on.
Yeah, I mean, I will say there's definitely stuff that doesn't work. I think in any business, I think anyone who's honest will say that there's more stuff that doesn't work than does. I'm just very quick at burying the stuff that doesn't work and moving on, and I don't dwell on it, and therefore nobody else dwells on it, and therefore you didn't see any of it.
That makes sense. Now, I want to talk about everything, but just for the people that maybe haven't heard of you before, or don't know who you are, let's give them a bit of a frame of reference, because your background is in magic, but these days, you don't really do much magic at all, if anything. Now, it's all hypnotism, but your background was in magic, wasn't it? That's how you kind of got into this industry.
Yes, so standard story you'll hear a lot at the beginning. I was a weird, shy, nerdy child. I was very lucky that I found magic very young. So I was like 4, probably. And I was living in Northwest London, and I went to see a kids entertainer. It was a guy called Smarty Artie. I later in life found out there was a chain of Smarty Arties. It was like a little franchise operation or something. Anyway, went to see the original Smarty Artie, I believe, and fell in love with magic instantly. At this play group that I went to, nursery equivalent. And I sort of pestered my parents to get me a magic set. And we went to a toy shop one day, and I was pestering them to get me a magic set. And my dad said, no, because you'll just lose all of the bits. And we left, and I ended up with a Sooty and Sweep puppet instead. That was like the compromise. And then a while later, I pestered them some more. We went back to the toy shop and got a Paul Daniels magic set, came home, became obsessed with it. So that would have been when I was about 5. And it was literally everyone who came to the house then had to see a magic trick. And I fell in love with it, pursued it. That was all I wanted to do. When I was like 10, 11, started entering competitions. So I was a Northern Magic Circle junior. I was in the Young Magicians Club down at the Magic Circle. So I won the close-up competition, the first ever year that the Magic Circle hosted it after the Reading Day had stopped. I won that, and then which was epic. And then I got into the finals of the Young Magician of the Year the first time I did it. Didn't quite make the finals the second time that I did it, doing a dove act, because I had very little personality. I was really bad at anything with patter. Looked grumpy as hell even doing a dove act. And so that was that. And it was during that time I saw a hypnotist on, I sort of saw old reruns on Bravo of Paul McKenna's TV show. And Darren was obviously on the scene and using hypnosis, albeit not calling it that. And just sort of started to get interested in that world. And I remember I was sort of studying for GCSEs at the time. And my dad's always been very supportive of everything I've done entertainment wise. And he sort of said, why don't you Why don't you wait till you get your GCSEs out of the way? You'll be 16 then, 16, 17, and then investigate this hypnosis route. I chose to ignore that advice. I borrowed his credit card and bought some DVDs off the internet off the very controversial Jonathan Royal. Alex Smith bought his DVDs. That was my first introduction to how it worked and what it was. Studied those, fell in love with it, and knew I was either going to be a magician, a hypnotist, or a both, and kind of pursue that route. So that's kind of how I got into magic and into this crazy world that we're in.
So was it always like you're entering competitions from a very young age? You were in the Young Magic Circle, the Northern Magic Circle. Was the goal always to be a professional performer? Was it like, right, okay, I'm going to get through school, get that out of the way. This is my goal. This is what I want to do.
Sort of. Cynthia Neptune, who ran the Northern Magic Circle Juniors at the time, she was quite old-fashioned with it all. And very sensibly, as most older magicians, I think, would probably advise kids, get a proper job, go to uni or whatever, get qualifications, get a trade of some description, and then try magic. And if it doesn't work, you've got something to fall back on. And that was always the plan. So I did my GCSEs and I stayed on for sixth form and did my A levels. And it gets to the UCAS bit. For anyone not in the UK, that's like our university entrance system. It gets to the UCAS bit where you get to sort of decide what university you might go to. And I was playing around. I even went to York St. John University, had a look around, like looked at the accommodation and stuff. And again, I was a really shy, terrified, socially awkward person. And I was sort of on that path. And then just at the right time, my dad said, don't go to university, finish your A-levels. And then, because that's, you can come back and do uni at any time in life. A-levels you can, but it's harder. You'd be a bit more of an obscure case if you came back in your 50s to do A-levels. But he said, just, you've got your A-levels, you'll have your A-levels under your belt. And I was sort of on track to do all right. I'm not particularly academic, but I was going to do all right. And then he said, and then take a gap year, try entertainment, see how it goes. And if it doesn't, then you can go back to uni, as opposed to doing the uni bit at 18. Racking up loads of debt and the whole student life thing, and then coming out of that at 22, 23 or 22, something like that, going off and trying it with all this debt under your belt. He said, I can't ever see you having a job. I just can't. So just give it a blast and see what happens. So I did, and that kind of fell in line with some opportunities that came my way at the time. And so I didn't, and I've never gone back. So that was the plan was get a proper job, try magic, and have a fallback option. It just didn't work out that way.
Well, you never know where life leads you, but it's really cool that like your dad was so supportive. I've spoken to so many people on this channel, and a lot of them say, "Oh, my dad hated magic. My mom hated magic. They always constantly told me to get a proper job." And here's you going, "No, your dad's going, no, don't go to uni. Follow your dreams. Yeah. This is what you want to do. This is what you're good at." That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I was really lucky in that respect because I was raised, we moved up to the Northeast and I was raised in Sunderland. And but we used to like trek down to the Magic Circle for the Young Magicians Club meetings, not every month, but like pretty close. My dad and my stepmom would take me down, drop me off. They'd go off around London and shop and whatever, and then pick me up and we'd come back. And they much prefer magic to the hypnosis stuff I'm doing now. They would have much rather I was a professional magician. but yeah, they used to sit and watch me. I was practicing cups and balls for my close-up competition act at the time. And my dad would always sit and watch, and if he ever sort of missed the final load of anything, he would say, "I knew you got it that time." He's got no magical background at all, just through watching me do it and stuff. Mm-hmm. But sometimes I would he wouldn't see the load happen, and he was like, "Well done, I didn't see it that time, and I knew it was coming." So like every now and then, not all the time, but every now and then you just nail it. So yeah, they were super supportive in that regard. So I like that. For that, I feel insanely lucky.
And were you doing gig before this gap year? Were you doing gigs? Like, were you out gigging in the evenings and weekends? Were you doing like kid shows or close up or something? Or what were you doing?
Bits of everything. So as you sort of implied in the introduction, I've probably got a short attention span, and I was one of those people, and it always made me feel unsuccessful at the time. I always remember, I always felt like successful people, this was my perception at the time, successful people would figure out what they wanted to do, and they would go on a a fairly straight line to get there. Of course, there's going to be, you know, I was always realistic. I knew there was going to be little failures along the way and stuff. But, you know, they would follow that path and they would get there. Whereas in my life, I've done loads of different things within the entertainment sphere. So I've done kids' parties. I did a local radio show for Sun FM, a radio station in Sunderland for 2 years. I did, you know, just started doing the overnights and kind of worked my way up a bit. So I did that. We had a little mobile disco company with my friend Gary, and we'd go out and we would do that. So I tried lots of different things, but it really started when I was about 15. So my first introduction to hypnosis was when I was 14. I bought the DVDs and stuff I wasn't supposed to buy and studied them. Got forgiven from that for that quite quickly. Went through the process of learning it. And when I was 16, pushing on 17, I did my first hypnosis show. So I'd been doing magic for a while, doing mostly kids' parties, weddings. Martin Duffy, the magician up here in the Northeast, he had quite a lot of contracts for local restaurants like TGI Fridays and stuff in the Northeast. So I used to go out and do those for him and a few others. So I had that kind of thing. I used to go out and do little wedding fairs. Terrible at that, because I just hated talking to humans. So anything I got out of that was pure luck, no skill there at all. And I just started doing, I did my first ever close-up magic gig paid for a company called Waterstones, not the bookshop, the people who make checks, when I was 13. At a castle in the Northeast, lost a woman's engagement ring. How's that for a first paid gig? And cried. So that was that. So I was doing gigs and like working my way through it. And then I did my first hypnosis show when I was 16. So I was kind of doing all of that alongside GCSEs and then alongside my A-levels. So again, for anyone not in the UK, that's like 17, 18. I was doing, some nights I'd be out doing close-up magic at a wedding. Sometimes I was going to be doing a hypnosis show in a pub. And sometimes I was doing kids magic during the day, finish a party at 6, have to dash off to get to a pub for 9 to do a hypnosis show. So it was just cramming it all in, doing as much as possible, really.
So when you decided to take this gap year and ended up doing it full time, you'd kind of already built up work. I mean, it wasn't like you were just going into it cold and you'd never done a gig before. Like, okay, where am I getting my work from? You built it up to a point that you just knew that there was going to be something there when you started, right?
Yeah, exactly. I knew I had something. And then just as that sort of happened, I'd also sort of made friends with another hypnotist in the Northeast, Adam Knight. And he had been offered, Adam was older than me, married with kids, different stage of life. And he'd been offered a summer season working in Kavos in Corfu, and he couldn't do it for obvious reasons. The money's not incredible. It's lots of gigs for small amounts of money. The money's not incredible, and obviously you just can't relocate at that time in your life very easily. So he just said, do you want it? And I took that. So that kind of lined up really nicely as well, although that was a bit of an adventure. So that fell in line with it all as well. But it meant that I was sort of falling out of love with doing kids magic. I knew that that wasn't the future I wanted. It was easy for me, and the money is good. And we just built a really good reputation really quickly. I had some friends who were studying you'll be able to resonate with this. I had some friends who were studying performing arts at college. And we were booking more kids work than I could do. So to the point that just through being purely disorganized, I ended up double booking myself sometimes. So there were two guys, Lee and Richie, who were doing performing arts, and I took them and taught them my magic show, bought duplicates of everything. So at one point I was out in three parties at the same time. So that went on for a couple of years as well. So I knew that that wasn't the future I wanted. So eventually I sort of backed out of doing it. But it was a really good few years and a really good grounding at that stage in life.
And going on the tour to Kavos?
The first one was Corfu, yeah.
I mean, did that solidify for you, you know what, this is what I want to be doing. I want to be doing the hypnotism, because you were probably doing it like every night, if not a couple of times a night in a situation like that, right?
Yeah, Corfu was a weird season. There was a bit of a misunderstanding. So I'd never been on like a package holiday before. As a kid growing up, we went to my dad likes driving. So we would like drive around Europe to like Germany, and got a friend who has a magic hotel in Germany. So we'd go down to Bavaria and go there. Like, we did drivey type holidays rather than package beach holidays. So I'd never been to Spain or Greece or any of these places really before. And I just knew that I was going to this place called Kavos. I knew that I was going to be working in a bar called Playland, which sounds horrendous. And I was going to be working with this guy. The manager was called Vangelis, didn't speak much English, but the owner spoke no English. And so I just have to figure it out. So me and my one of my best mates, Gary, who was an amateur theatre technician, now a professional theatre technician, he was working for a company at the time and he'd just been fired. And so he was looking for a thing to do. He hadn't been fired, he left. He was looking for a thing to do. And he was looking for a new job, but at the same time was ready for a bit of a break. And I said, look, I'm going to Cavos for a few months. I think it was only going to be 3 months. Do you want to come out and kind of just, he's 3 years older than me and just a bit more worldly wise. He was in his early 20s. And just have a month, have the first month with me. I'll pay for it. You do the tech for my show. You can live with me. I've got two beds in the flat I'm going to be staying in, so that'll be fine. So Gary came out, and that was a lifesaver, really, because I got there and I would have been killed. If I just turned up there myself, like, I wouldn't have known what I was doing, like, couldn't looked after myself on my own at all. So that was useful. And when I got there, what I found out is that I was in a bar next door to a different bar that had another hypnotist on, also from Newcastle, who'd been put there by the same guy who sent me out. But neither of us knew. Basically, what Adam and I knew was that this other hypnotist was being sent to Corfu and I was being sent to Cavos, and neither of us knew that Cavos was in Corfu. And I didn't know that Aaron was going there, and he didn't know that I was going there either, nor did Adam intentionally put us in the same resort in two bars that were next door to each other. Now, these bars already had a rivalry anyway, and the other hypnotist, who'll remain nameless, when I got there, he was under the impression that I was there to try and cause trouble and try and, like, cause all sorts of riots and kick off and stuff. So that was that led to it being quite a difficult season. The bars were in competition anyway, and they were fighting to have each other's shows cancelled. I was just trying to get on with the time and have a good time there. There were enough people there. We weren't causing each other any problems. But he took it quite differently and was quite difficult about the whole thing. He was, I think he's younger than I was. He was probably only 16 or 17 or something at the time. So, like, even he was, I think if he looked back at it now, he would probably feel bad about the way things went. Anyway, so I stuck it out for a further couple of months. And then when that came to an end, I was like, right, I'm done. I'm ready to go home. But then the next year, Adam called me again and said, I've had another offer to go to the island of Kos. And I was like, looked into it, made sure there were no other hypnotists there. And certainly not one in a bar next door. And took that offer, and that was amazing. So that turned into another 3 years of working abroad and doing and actually living that life properly and doing what it was supposed to look like.
That's amazing. And would you agree that there's, like, no substitute for sort of experience and flight time? Because I hear these days a lot of people going, oh, right, you start off as a professional entertainer, you need to be commanding massive fees right from the beginning, which is great. But surely you need to kind of make sure that your act is, like, worth the price that you're going to be charging. And a lot of people these days, they come into magic or performing and they don't want to go through that sort of situation. But going to somewhere like that, or the House of Illusion, or, you know, any of these places, it's a massive pay cut, but the experience is worth its weight in gold, right?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, the first hypnosis show I ever did in the UK, this was not the case with the first magic show I did, because I had so much experience of doing magic since I was five, and it was all I did. I just went out and started charging for that, albeit quite cheap fees. I thought they were good fees at the time. I just didn't know they weren't. Like, my first ever 13-year-old gig was 150 quid for 2 hours of close-up magic. And I thought, that's amazing. That's incredible. But obviously, a lot of people would look down on that. But anyway, but my first ever three hypnosis shows in the UK, two of them I did for free in local pubs because I didn't know if it's going to work or not. Like, I'd learned the stuff. I'd never actually hypnotized anyone before, because the old sort of thing is always, if you try and hypnotize your friends who know you're just learning, it's unlikely to work because of how much belief is required in order to get it to work. So I just went out and did them for free. I didn't know if it was going to work or not. The third one I did for £200, but it was in London. It was on a boat called the Wibbly Wobbly, which used to be owned by Jules Holland, apparently, before I did it. And it was offered to me by another hypnotist. They basically said, that's all the budget is, and he couldn't afford to go down and do it for that. And he said, look, if you go and do it, that'll cover your petrol. You're effectively doing it for free. So I basically did three gigs for free at first, and then went out to, and then that led to paid work around pubs and stuff in the Northeast. Then I went abroad. But yeah, so overseas, I think, obviously, years ago, there was this national service and everyone had to go off and fight in the army. I think now everybody should have to go and do at least a summer season, even if it's working PRing to get people into a bar or waitressing or whatever, I think everyone should have to go and do a season abroad, because it completely changed the person that I am. Like, for the, not that I'm brilliant, but it changed the human I am for the better. Just being able to go and do that. And you have to find out where the laundrette is and how that works. Like, just simple things that, like, that I think kids are too protected nowadays. I know I was wrapped in bubble wrap. And I think it's got worse over time.
Yeah.
And I think just being thrust into a place where it's a safe environment, you're surrounded by other people who are like you. I made some of the best friends you can imagine while I was out there. The day I arrived, there were some like workers who'd been there for seasons before who were hanging around at one of the bars. And I just made friends with them that night, moved into the same flats that they were staying in. And we were just thick as thieves for the whole season and all the time I was there. So I think everyone should have to do it, whether you're an entertainer or not.
You said earlier on that when you were younger, you were socially awkward, and so was it this experience that kind of changed that? Because, you know, I can think of many words to describe you. Socially awkward is not one of them. So at some point, that changed, right? Was it this experience?
Yeah, that kind of... I genuinely think it is. When I went out there, I didn't drink. So like, I remember when we did our like end of sixth form like wrap up, most people went out for like a night out in the nightclubs and stuff. And I went out for half an hour and it was just not my scene at all. I hated it. Felt so out of place and went home. And when I went out to Kos, I didn't drink at all when I was in Corfu in that season. When I went out to Kos, a drink for me would be two bottles of Smirnoff Ice, maybe, you know, some sort of Alco Pop type thing, VK Orange, whatever it was at the time. And by the end of that fourth season, I'm not advocating excessive drinking, but like I knew how to talk to people. I was happy to go out and have a drink. It just completely changed who I am. So yeah, I put the vast majority of it down to that. And also, you're sort of thrust into a spotlight where you are a celebrity in that island. So I had my face on big posters and flyers all over the place. There was really only, especially in Kos at the time, there were very few entertainers. There was me, there was a Roy Chubby Brown tribute act, there was a comedian, there was a couple of singers who did a double act. And I think that was it. There was an Elvis tribute act for a very short period of time. And so you instantly become well known. You and like the DJs from the three big nightclubs in the main resort are sort of the most famous people on the island, as it were. And so that sort of changes the perspective a bit, because now people are coming to talk to you everywhere. If you sat by the pool, families are coming over and saying, oh, we saw your show last night, it was great or whatever. And so that I think changes the perspective. And I think if you're an entertainer in these resorts anywhere, that becomes the case. You're talked about a lot. And so that does artificially inflate your confidence to a point where that makes a difference.
That's really interesting. Now, let me ask you another question. At the end of these four seasons, you're obviously going to come back to the UK at this point. I suppose two questions. What made you come back to the UK? You're loving this life. You're going there. You're having a great time every single year. What made you kind of go, right, okay, now I have to move on? Yeah. And also, had you at this point kind of basically just decided, right, magic is not for me, as much as I love it, and as much as I still go to conventions, like I know you do, and you're still involved in the community as a performer, you kind of more, that's it, your hypnotism. Or when you were coming back to the UK, were you thinking, oh, I might have to do magic again? Because I speak to a lot of cruise liner magicians who have basically don't need to get any work in the UK because they're just constantly going out on cruises. And then when they come back, it's kind of like, oh my God, I've got no brand. I've got no business over here. So where were you at that point? Like,
yeah, so I had sort of decided. So what was happening was I was going out every year and I came home in like October-ish. The season's over there then, and I'd stay on for a little bit longer and then get the last direct flight out of Kos back to home. And I was staying with my parents for the few months in the winter, then going back out about March time. And so in that period of time, I didn't do very much performance-wise for those few months I was at home. And it was when I was probably about halfway through, so probably after two seasons, at that point I decided I don't want to do magic anymore. I mean, I wasn't doing magic overseas anyway. I wasn't doing magic in Kos anyway. And I wasn't doing very much of it when I was back in the UK. And I just got to a point where two things had happened. One, I consider myself a very average magician. Definitely not the worst. And there's people much better than me. And more than that, I consider myself to not have a great deal to offer that's unique and interesting and cool. So the magic that I like to watch is the magic that's creative and different and innovative, and it isn't the latest packet trick from whoever. Even though the public love that stuff, and I'm not taken away from it at all, I think, you know, if you go out and do a gig in a wedding or a restaurant and you do the most skillful magic in the world, creative and unique, or you do something completely as it came off the dealer shelf, the public aren't going to know. But just something about my nature wanted to be able to do stuff that was different and interesting. And I couldn't, just didn't have anything particularly unique to offer in the magic world. And so I, for that reason, I didn't get the fulfillment out of doing it that I would. I remember my close-up set to this day was Coins Through Silk, the way that Michael Amar does it. And it was exactly his presentation and his performance. I do a sponge ball routine that was just an amalgamation of other people's stuff, and a card in wallet routine that I'd learned from Mike O'Brien a million years ago, and did it exactly the way he did it. And so, and I just got to the point where I was bored of approaching tables, didn't want to do it. Just didn't like doing it at all. So that for me was the sign: if you're not enjoying something, you should stop doing it.
Yeah.
So I chose to stop doing it. Still love it. I've got a deck of cards in my hand now. Still love it. I still always have a deck of cards next to me somewhere to fiddle with. But I knew that I woke up when I had a hypnosis show and I had a buzz out of it, because it was just giving me so much more fulfillment. So I knew I was going to stick to that when I went back. The reason why I finished the season at the end of the fourth year was twofold. Number one, the resort was getting really quiet. The Greek islands, with the exception probably of Malia, but I've never been, go in these weird cycles where they'll spend like 4 to 7 years being super busy, and then they'll die off. And Kos has always seems to have been the sort of weird little brother of the other islands. It's the one that fewest people have heard of, and the one that fewest people have been to. Everyone's heard of Zante and Corfu and Malia and places like that, but very few people have heard of Kos, still millions of people, but in relation, it's not the famous one of them. And it was starting to dry up. The people who'd been there for like 15 seasons in a row, they were like, yeah, we've never seen it be this quiet. And it was getting to the point where gigs were getting cancelled, and it's very much a culture of, if there's no gig, there's no money, you don't get paid. So that was happening. I also met a girl who I ended up engaged to and then split up with, but we were together for quite a few years, and that was sort of starting to formulate. So that was another reason to come back to the UK. And then at the end of the last season, it was the day I was due to fly home. I had no money because I was just spending every penny, every euro, every cent that I made. I wandered down to one of the bars that I used to do my show in called Origin, and I had a laptop, and I put it on the bar, and I said hello to the guy behind the bar, and I climbed up onto the bar stool. And the next thing I know, I woke up on my back crying with Sarah, one of the girls that worked there, leaning over me. And she's like, Rob, are you all right? Rob, are you all right? And I was like, what's happened? She went, you sort of just fell off fell off the stool, smacked your head on the tile, and had a fit. And I was like, I don't have fits. I'm relatively healthy. I don't have anything that would cause you to have a fit. So they called the ambulance. I said, don't call the ambulance, call a taxi, because there's one ambulance on the island. You might as well call the ice cream man. So they called the taxi, went off to Costown Hospital, stitches in my head. They said, we're going to have to keep you in for a few days. They put me on a drip. Anyway, after lots of stuff and brain scans and stuff that they did, it turned out there was nothing wrong with me. I was just exhausted. I'd had too much to drink. I was malnourished, hadn't eaten properly, even though I used to go out and eat in restaurants all the time, rather than having a pot noodle at home like most people did out there. And I was like, this is it. I would have been 23, 24, something like that. 23, I think, or 22. So I'm ready to come home. Things were happening with my ex, now ex, then girlfriend. And I was like, so I'm gonna go home. So I did. I rang my dad. I was like, can you book me another flight home? Now that I'm out of hospital and whatnot. So he did. I came and got checked up in the UK. They said much the same stuff as the doctors out there did. And that was it. I was like, right. I looked at the other entertainers who were out there for a bit, who were now in their 50s. And you could tell that they'd done what I've just done, apart from the hospital bit, every year for the last 20 years. And I was like, I don't want to be doing that. I want to settle down, get married one day, have kids one day. I want to pursue that. And that just didn't seem conducive to that life. But while I was there, I sort of retrospectively figured it out. In that time of being abroad, I'd racked up somewhere in the realms of 1,000 shows and like just worked really hard. And so I'm 22, 23, and I've got 1,000 shows under my belt. And I looked at it and I thought, I mean, to do 1,000 shows in the UK where you can't do more than, where you're unlikely to do more than one a night, you're definitely unlikely to be working 6-7 nights a week. I just had such a, I just feel really privileged and lucky to have had that opportunity at that early in my life. So at that point I was like, right, it's time to go home now.
Wow. So I alluded to this earlier on in the interview. You're an incredible business person. You just are. Like, you understand business inside out and back to front. But you never studied business at school. I mean, you just said you did your A-levels, and then you spent years working over abroad where you don't really need to run a business. You don't need marketing. You don't need to know about any aspect of business, really. You just have to turn up, do your show. So you're coming back to the UK with a kick-ass show because you've been doing 1,000 shows over the last 4 years. You've got an incredible product, but you're almost going to have to start again because you've just said over the last 3 or 4 years, you weren't even performing that much. Before you left, you were doing magic. So it's a case of starting again. I know that you were successful doing that and then some, but did that make you nervous coming back? What was your kind of strategy? Was it like, I'm going to have to figure out this business side of things? Because that's where a lot of people are. A lot of people are listening to this. They're in that situation where they've got a great show or they feel like they've got a product they can offer people, but they don't know how to actually get from where they are to wherever they want to be. And I know where you've got to, what happened coming back to the UK?
Yeah, there's really two things that happened. The first thing is that while I was out there, I did come to the realization that I was getting like 150, 200 euros a show out there, and therefore making up to a couple of thousand euros a week. And I thought, and then just literally spending it all. And I knew that when I came home, I wouldn't be able to get that level of work to be able to sustain that. And I didn't know what I was going to do. So I did two things. The first thing is I wanted to find other streams of income. So the first thing that I did was I realized that, for example, people sell courses and downloadable stuff on the internet marketers, as they become known. And I started to study that. And I used to sell Stop Smoking and Weight Loss CDs and stuff after my show, just that were just mass burnt on the little local CD chat. And I realized I obviously have those as an MP3, so I could sell those on the internet. People could download them and that would work. So I spent probably 6 months. I'm incredibly nerdy anyway, and sitting by the pool or on a beach doesn't interest me, which is why I have this complexion. And I would sit in a bar by a pool instead, on my laptop. And I spent probably 6 or 8 months learning how to write one of those long scrolly sales letters that everyone will have come across, and learning how to put a thing on a network on the internet and have people promote it and pay them commissions as an affiliate and that kind of thing. So I learned the principles of internet marketing for like 6, 7, 8 months of one season, put up my Stop Smoking product. I think I called it yourbigquit.com, not even a good domain, but like it was available at the time. It's on Web Archive somewhere. So I put that up. And after all of this work and trial and effort, I think I probably sold like 5 copies of it or something, and just didn't figure that out at all. So I was, but I had a bunch of knowledge in my head now, at least, of how to do those things, even though I didn't know how to drive loads of people at it. I also realized the other problem with selling a Stop Smoking product is that if it works, people don't need to ever buy anything from you again because they've stopped smoking. So I was there's a bit of a brick wall there. There's nothing else to sell those people. But I had this thing in my brain that when I come back to the UK, if I could get to the point where I could make a couple of grand in a month from just selling stuff on the internet, that was in line with my hypnosis stuff, that would help. And then I can figure out the market when I get back here. That was the first bit. The second bit was just before I came home, I did a Skype call with our friend Kennedy. And he was doing incredibly well in the corporate market in the UK as a mentalist, still is, was storming it. His fees were good. I'd sort of seen the inside of his business because we used to talk. We'd still do. Obviously, I've got business to do with him now, but we used to talk a lot at the time. And I knew that what he was doing was small numbers of gigs for larger amounts of money. And so I was like, how do I do that? And that was my question. How do I do what you're doing as a hypnotist? And he said, you've got to find the market that will pay what you want to charge them. So I immediately just looked at the market and said, where could I do gigs that could pay me? At the time, I wanted to charge £1,000, where most hypnotists were charging 250, sometimes £150. And so I just went universities, that's, I reckon they've got money, because I just did the sums on what I think Freshers Week probably makes them in terms of selling freshers passes. There's loads of them. And I went, I'm going to be the university hypnotist. Didn't ever want to call it that. I was just like, in my head, that's going to be my market. Quite like the idea of doing corporate stuff, although it's much harder as a hypnotist in the UK. But I thought, well, we'll give that a bash. And so I came home and two things happened. One, I cracked the selling things on the internet bit by becoming the marketing behind one product that the aforementioned controversial Jonathan Royal Alex Smith. I did a bunch of marketing behind something he did, and that made a bunch of money. And then I just went head down. How do I become the guy that universities hire in the UK? So for the next few years, my core market in the UK was really weddings and universities, just because they had budgets. And I just went hell for leather after those two things. And that was it. Cause that way I knew that if I charged £1,000, which is what I wanted to charge, I knew that pubs couldn't afford me generally. So some did, some like went all out and did a show and sold tickets and made it work, or didn't make it work, but had a good night. I don't know what the economics of that were for them, but most pubs couldn't afford that. Equally, I was no longer in competition with really anyone else in the UK, because there were very few people charging that sort of price. And so I just came home and said, that's what I'm going to do. It's going to be two bits to my life. One is selling stuff on the internet that is of interest to me. So we were selling hypnosis training to hypnotists. And the other bit is doing gigs. And I knew that I wanted my fee at the time to be a grand. That's what I'm going to do. And so I did, just came home. And I thought, I've got very little to lose. I'm only 22. I have nothing. I lived with my parents for the next 6 months until I figured out somewhere to live. And I was like, I've got nothing to lose. I might as well charge what to me at the time was a ridiculous amount of money. Because if nobody pays it, I've literally got nothing to lose. Don't have a mortgage, don't have kids. I'm just going to go for it. And I just did.
For people outside of the UK, you need to understand that you're in Newcastle doing this, right, which isn't London. Like, it's one of the less affluent areas in the UK in terms of people's budgets. Would you agree with that? So the fact that you did that in that area as well, as opposed to being in like somewhere like central London, where it wouldn't be too difficult, is just, yeah, you know, it's just even more amazing.
And I did travel. That's the only other thing, is I'm not attached to being local either. So I was prepared to jump in the car and drive down to do a gig in Coventry. If Coventry University wanted me, then I was happy to do that as well. So yeah, just for me, that became the thing for the next few years, really.
Wow. So what advice would you give somebody who's listening to this that wants to make a business for themselves? Would you say what you just said there, niching down, creating a brand, is that probably one of the most important things?
Yeah, I mean, for me, try loads of stuff till you figure out what you actually enjoy and what you don't want to do. At the same time, I know a bunch of magicians who dabbled in stage hypnosis and just decided they didn't like it, either because they had a tough first gig. I was lucky. I had a really good first gig, and that gives, my second one was ropey, but the first one was excellent. And that really gives you a bit of a kick. So try loads of stuff and see what you want to do. Like I said, we did mobile discos. I did a radio show. I did loads of stuff. And figure out what the bit you enjoy doing. That's fine. That completely broke much later in life. I broke this idea that successful people just start doing a thing and do it till it's successful. I realized actually there's nothing wrong with changing direction. So do loads of stuff. And once you figure out what it is that you want to do, just look for a sort of a gap in the market. So I just realized that there wasn't really like a more premium price stage hypnotist in the UK who wasn't squabbling over pub gigs and bingo halls and that kind of thing. Universities were hiring hypnotists, but they were hiring hypnotists at low hypnotist prices because hypnotists didn't know what they could charge. So just look for that opportunity, I think. Look for the gap in that place. And then just, I think it's partly luck. This bit is partly luck for me, is just being in the right place to just do loads of it until you are really confident in the delivery of the thing.
Okay, that's really, really good advice. So how long did the university thing last for? Because obviously I know you was doing tours and theatre tours and corporates. And, you know, although at the time the university thing, £1,000, that's really good, it's still capped at around about that. And I know what you do now, you charge a lot more for. When did you kind of get into your head, right, okay, from a forget about the other stuff, forget about the side businesses, we'll talk about that, but from a performer point of view, you know, I'm kind of limiting myself doing this, focusing on universities, I need to take this to the next level.
Partly an accident. So I was doing the unis for at least 8 years, I reckon, till I was, or maybe seven or eight years, something like that. And that was really good. And then I made a name for myself in that industry, in that bit of the industry. And still today, people contact me and say, I'd love to get into doing universities. How do you do it? And I don't really have a good answer. I just hustled. I wrote old long form direct mail sales letters and sent them off to try and find the person who was going to be the booker. It's hard to find the bookers in university. Sometimes it's a member of staff. Sometimes it's just somebody on the union committee. It was hard, but it just had to go for it. And then word spreads after a while. So I got to a point where I decided I wanted to try doing cruises. Partly because, again, Kennedy and I are sort of best mates, and he was doing cruises, and I sort of liked the look and the feel of what he was doing. So I was like, I'd like to try that. So one of the things everyone had told me, I don't know if it's true or not, but everyone had told me at the time, is you really need to have a showreel that looks like it was filmed in the sort of theatres they have on ships. So I thought, well, I can do that. I could hire a theatre locally to me. I could sell tickets to cover the cost. I'll get it filmed and get it edited. So I rang Russ Stevens and said, will you come? And you're obviously incredibly well versed on cruise ships, and you have a video production thing, and you make trailers for entertainers. Can I hire you to come and do to film this gig for me? And he was like, yeah, that's fine. So we agreed a price, and he came up to do that. I hired the Tyne Theatre and Opera House in Newcastle, just because it was the easiest theatre to hire. It holds 1,100 people, so it's a big place over four levels. And I've always loved theatre anyway. My stepmom was a drama teacher. Like, I've gone to theatre all my life. So I was dead excited to do that. And that day, me and Kennedy and my other mate, I feel lucky to work with my two best mates. Kennedy was sort of helping me with the production side of it all. Gary, who I mentioned earlier, he was by this point working professionally in theatre. And so he does all the tech for my show. He did my very first pub gig, Hypnosis Show, when I was 16, and he's still working with me now. So that's awesome. And so we were just in the theatre. We hired in a sound system because the theatre didn't have one. We hired in shed loads of lights, like an arena worth of moving lights and all sorts, from a local company, massive screen projections, paid people who make visual graphics to make the animations and stuff, and went all out. We sold about 700 tickets or something, so the theater at that point, the theater feels full enough. Like, the bottom three levels are mostly full, top one's empty, that's fine. You get nosebleeds up there anyway, and so we put on a really good show. Russ came and filmed it. I think he was probably more impressed than he expected to be. He'd never seen anything I'd done before. And I think he probably was more impressed by it once he'd seen what we actually pulled off. Anyway, so he edited the thing together, and I ended up with this showreel. And that day I was sat in the theater, and I turned to Kennedy. We were sat in the auditorium, and I said, mate, I'd love to do this every day. There's something about being in theaters I just loved. So I'd love to just every day rock up to a different city, do this whole get up thing. We were there from about 9 o'clock, and we were slow because we'd never done it before. So like, it took us forever, and we put in far more stuff than we needed. And I was like, I'd love to just get to a different theater in a different city every day and just do this and just make it happen. I just sort of said it, and it just sort of sat with me for a few months. And then a few years later, it took a few years, and I was still going ahead. That was in 2014. I sort of parked the cruise thing and was continuing to do unis. And I just thought, I loved it. I was doing an annual theatre show in that theatre. And I just thought, I'd love to do this and see if I can make it work. So I just picked a random couple of weeks where I had no gigs in April of 2018. And I said, I'm just going to try and find five theatres across the UK. So that'll be one of them, because that's sort of already dealt with. And then I'll find four more, and I'll just try and do a little micro tour of those theatres. And there's loads to learn there. Like, every year I did the Tyne Theatre, I learned something that did or didn't work to sell a theatre show. So once I paid a company £1 a poster to put 1,000 posters around the city centre, they ended up illegally fly posting them all around the city, and I nearly got a very big fine, but managed to talk my way out of it. And that just didn't have any impact at all. So that was £1,000 just wasted. So I just learned very quickly what did and didn't work. And then I did this, I sort of said, I'll contact a bunch of theatres. I'll try and get four of them plus the Tyne to do this little micro tour in 2018. And just see if the concept works outside of my hometown. And before long, I had 17 theatres replied and said, yes, how about this date? And I just went, all right. And so I managed to get 17 booked in over 19 days. There was only like 2 days off. And I just went, right, we're just going to go for it. So Kennedy and I worked on the show. Gary did all the tech. We hired all the tech, all of the actual touring tech, moving lights and stuff that a lot of theatres don't have in-house, from a local guy called Darren who had a van. And on the road, there was going to be me, Kennedy, Gary, Darren. And I wanted a sort of assistant type character to help. So I had a magician's assistant type character, hypnotist assistant, a friend of ours called Sally, who's a dancer and was just not working at the time. So like, great, that'll all be good. So we went on the road. We had the best 19 days you can imagine, not without problems. So we cancelled 3 shows just because they didn't sell well enough. I did a show in St. Helens, which was probably the worst show I've ever done in my life. Getting volunteers out of the audience was just harder than I've ever known it be before or since. And when we did get them up, they were obviously doing it because, well, there's no show if nobody volunteers. So they were sort of being forced up by their friends. And then when you get to the interval, as is not surprising given that set of circumstances, they all sort of decided, they all sort of snapped out of it and decided, I don't want to take part in the second half. By law, you have to say, no, that's fine, and send them back. And so the second half of the show didn't happen. The management of the theatre were very unhappy, as you can imagine. It's actually just owned by a woman and her mother. It's not like a huge trust or like a huge council-run building or anything like that. It's just two people who own it. And they were really annoyed. And the audience were annoyed. And they said to me on the phone, I was on the phone with the front of, so I was with the front of house manager on the phone to the management, and they said St. Helens can be a crowd that kick off when stuff doesn't go very well or they feel ripped off or whatever. And so we tried to explain it as best as we could, explain it to the front house manager, who was lovely, and she went out and tried to explain it to the crowd as best as we could. I snuck out a stage door, we got into the van and we disappeared, and just got off to the next night where we were staying in Manchester. So that was horrendous, and has earned me a bit of a bad reputation. And certainly with that theatre, they'll never have a hypnotist on again, is what they've said. And I put that down to being their decision rather than the thing I did, because that helps my mental health with it all. And then that was it. So it was definitely not flawless. Of the 17 gigs, I think in the end we only did 13, and then we had that one that was one of the 13, and that was rough. But I learned loads. I realised that. I learned lots about what sells tickets, what doesn't sell tickets, that kind of thing. And I said, right, we're going to do it again in 2019. We'll not go to St. Helens. And we'll basically, Luke Jermay gave me a bunch of advice about this ahead of the tour. And one of the things I learned is when you're not famous, you have to rely on finding theatres that have an audience who naturally want to see what you do. Yeah. And that won't be every theatre, because the cost of advertising, when you're not famous, the cost of advertising to get one person in is unmanageable. You'd probably have to spend 90 quid in advertising to get one person at 22 quid a ticket. It's just not possible. And so you have to rely on a lot of the in-house marketing. So you have to have a venue where there is an audience for your show, and their brochure, flyers and posters around the venue will do 90% of the heavy lifting. And so there's a bunch of theatres I knew from that first tour where we sold 300 tickets in a 1,000-seater theatre. I was like, this is not a venue for me. Then you had others where we sold, like Weymouth Pavilion's amazing. They put posters up and it sells really well. So like there's others where I go, this is definitely for me. I'll be back here next year. So I just worked with the venues that were willing to do it again the next year, added some new ones in. You don't realize how many theatres there are in the UK and theatres and art centres and stuff until you start trying to do this. And that was it. So I just sort of kept growing it. And after the first year, again, Luke said to me, before you go on tour, when you get to the end of the tour, he said, you will either decide this is for me and this is the route I want to take, or you'll say that was awful, I never want to do it again. And got to the end of it and I was like, this is the best thing in the world. I want to do this. And that was it. So I sort of, in that moment at the end of that tour, which lost money, at the end of that tour, I said, this is the life for me. I just need to figure out how to make it not lose money, how to make it make money. And then I want to grow it. So my goal now, and this is me talking now as we're recording this in January 2022, my goal now is that in 5 years from now, I'll be able to go to an average city do three nights in their theatre, because I will have built an audience through, I'm learning social media. That's totally not my forte at all. So I'm learning how to build an audience on Instagram and put out content and stuff to build an audience there to flog tickets to. So I'm learning that. But yeah, the plan in the next 5 years is to get it to that sort of point. I don't think I would never recommend anybody try and get into the theatre thing unless you've got somebody with deep pockets behind you putting it out. Because basically I got to a point, this is how I always word it, I got to a point where I knew I've got a theatre worthy product, apart from In St. Helens. I knew I had a theatre worthy product, and I knew that I had an option to either wait for a production company to find it, which is never going to happen. And I wasn't very good at going, and I've never been like Dominic Wood, always, you hear say the story about like knocking on the BBC's door every day from being like 10 saying, can I have a job please? I was never that. Never had the confidence or the balls to do that. And I think I knew nobody was going to find it. So I just thought, I've just got to do it myself. But if you do it yourself, and I knew if I did it myself and figured it out, the money would be better than having a production company take all the risk and just pay you a nightly fee for the gig. And I saw shows like The Illusionists was working with however many cast there was, isn't it? Seven unknown, unheard of magicians touring and selling out theatres in the UK just off the basis of the name The Illusionist. So I just said, right, that's it. The show's called Robert Temple in small letters, The Hypnotist in massive letters, and I'll just put a word after it. So the first one was The Hypnotist Live and Outrageous. This year's show's called The Hypnotist Red Raw. And so it's just going to be The Hypnotist in massive letters on the poster, so everybody knows without a shadow of a doubt what that is. Although that has a complication I didn't know. And that was it. I'm just going to figure it out and just keep going at it. So we've got to the point now where this year, so the last 2 years, obviously we've had COVID, so the tour was pushed back to this autumn. So this autumn I'm doing, I think it's like something like 32 theatres or something through September and October. Doing the Edinburgh Fringe first, which I'm considering a lot of work in progress gigs, lots of B23 gigs just to like get the new material right, and then go out with the proper show. We've scaled it down a lot now. It's me and one person on a road. We hire stuff in from the theatre, hire stuff in on our behalf rather than us trailing around with a big van and a car as well. Sort of just, I realised the profit here isn't in making the production lean, but without knocking the edge off the appearance of it all. So yeah, that's a long-winded way of telling you what's happening now.
That's amazing. But I mean, the biggest thing I'm taking from that is don't be afraid to take risks.
As long as you are, I am happy to sit in a place of pain and discomfort for a period of time if I believe in the end result sufficiently. So I lost a lot of money doing the theatre thing, a ton of money doing the theatre thing. But I just think that's the only way it was going to happen. The alternative was I could be sitting here today, 3 years on from when I first had the idea, 4 years on from when I first had the idea, thinking, or when I first did the tour, thinking, oh, this might be the year that somebody signs me and puts me out on the road and takes a risk on my show. Or I can be 4 years in. Obviously we've sacrificed 2 years to the pandemic, really, but I could be sat here 4 years in thinking, right, we've done it twice, didn't go brilliantly, but we started to figure out how to make money now. Let's start to scale it. So yeah, it was just that was it. So for me, I'm not particularly risk averse. I'm quite happy to like dive in and try stuff out.
And it's that old expression, isn't it? If it was easy, everybody would be doing it. So, you know, you've got to be prepared to go through some pain, right?
And I've had messages from hypnotists who are now working abroad and are sort of finding the same pains that I found with like resorts getting quieter. Again, obviously, it's been a particular problem in the last 2 years. And they're kind of, I've had messages from two hypnotists in the last couple of months saying, thinking about coming back to the UK, just wanted to pick your brains, get some advice on, you know, like obviously you're doing the theatre thing and I know you did the university thing. And my answer is, honestly, and this is not me trying to keep competition out of the market, I don't really care, I would advise anybody to not do the theatre thing unless you are willing to just throw loads of money at it for a long period of time. And I said I would advise taking the university circuit that I used to have, premium branded stuff like that, corporates, that kind of thing. That's what I would recommend anybody go for. But yeah, I just thought, and that's the reason why I'm really the only person doing it. Andrew Newton comes over a couple of times a year and does two or three theatres, the Leeds City Varieties, there's one in Rotherham. one somewhere else. Peter Powers comes over every year and does the Glasgow Pavilion and sells out like a string, a ridiculous number of shows in one city. Three shows a night, I think he does. And then for like three weekends on the trot. But apart from them, and I just stay off their turf completely, apart from them, no hypnotists are really doing the theatre thing in the UK. So I was wow. like, I'm gonna make that my thing.
Yeah, and you know, when you make it profitable and you really nail it, I mean, you've got something that hardly anybody else will be able to replicate, because, you know, it's going to be very difficult for them to get to where you are, even more difficult than it was for you, because now you're solidified in that market, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, I think that is the answer. I think the answer is, if you can, and if you're, again, I'm lucky, I'm not married yet, I don't have kids yet. If you can sit in discomfort for a while and just stare at the thing in the face and say, other non-famous people have taken over and built an audience and being able to sell out theatre shows just because they've built an audience by doing it. And I'm convinced if you just stare at a difficult thing in the face long enough and say, I'm going to figure it out, eventually you will.
That's great. That's fantastic. Now, aside from the performing, because obviously we mentioned at the very, very beginning, I mentioned something, you mentioned something. I mentioned about how you've got a lot of side businesses, and you said it's very important to have extra sources of income. Yeah. I can see why now, because, I mean, you know, you're building up this theatre tour, which for 2 years has lost money. You have to have money coming in from elsewhere, or else you're kind of not able to do that.
Yeah.
And then at the same time, you said you've talked about Kennedy, and you've said, who is an amazing guy. And you said that you guys are in business together, which obviously I know about. And he reminds me very much of you. You're both from Newcastle. You're both very successful. You're both performers. You both perform at a very high level. You're both very, very good, but you both understand business inside out and back to front. And I think you've both got a desire to do something outside of performing as well and have those external sources of income. So I suppose the question is, while all this was going on, the universities and everything, what were you doing to generate that extra source of income and have other money coming in away from performing? And how did you and Kennedy end up going into business together?
Yeah, so we'd been mates for a long time. So we met when I was 14 and he would have been 17 at the South Tyneside Magic Convention that happens in the Northeast, and just very, very quickly became good pals. And had lots of stuff in common. We're very different humans, but we got lots of stuff in common, and we sort of just worked together quite well. So for a long time, we weren't in business together, but we, like, every idea I had, I would run past him, and every idea he had, he would run past me. And we used to sit sometimes on Skype before the days of Zoom. We would sit on Skype sometimes for an entire day, sometimes not saying a word to each other, just both independently doing our thing. But it sort of felt like we had a bit of a co-working space going on. This has become a thing now where businesses will pay to, like, remotely work with other people in other parts of the world on Zoom. But at the time, we were just figuring out, it was quite a lonely life when you sat at home on your own. Whereas if we could just be sat, I'm just sat doing my work, he sat doing his, and every now and then we'll exchange a couple of words. So we used to do that. And then we both fell into this world that I mentioned earlier of, like, packaging and selling courses and training and stuff on the internet. For him, that came about because he was teaching persuasion and influence. What we wanted to do was to take a thing, and obviously he'll tell you more about this, but we both wanted to sell a thing on the internet that was related to, we didn't suddenly want to go and become, we weren't going to start selling get rich quick schemes and all the, and pyramid schemes and all that stuff. We wanted to be able to sell stuff that was related to what we did and therefore was a good use of our time and expertise and stuff. So for him, he was teaching persuasion and influence, which works beautifully alongside working as a corporate mentalist. So we had a coaching program around that stuff. And I was selling, I was basically, as I said, the marketing bit behind one particular product that Jonathan Royal was putting out at the time, which was basically everything he'd ever produced as a seller of stuff. But instead of sending it out on a million DVDs like he used to do, I said, why don't you put it on the internet and people in China can just buy it and download it immediately, or people in Australia can buy it and download it immediately, and you don't have to sit in your house with a 16-disc DVD burner to send, that you have to, like, burn three times just to send one set out. And then have to ship it to the other side of the world and then have to wait weeks for it to go missing in the post. So you have to send another one out at your expense and all the hassle that comes with mail order stuff. So he said, well, I just don't know how to do any of that. And I said, I do, because I've put it all together for this stop smoking product I sold five of. So I can't say I've nailed the marketing bit, but I can definitely help you with getting it on the internet and you're already selling, I mean, he was selling a shed loads of these DVDs. So I said, put it on the internet. I'll put together the marketing bit. You've already got the content. It was like 100 hours of video content, I think, when it was all put together. So we put it all on the internet, and I went out and I recruited a bunch of other people to promote it. So people in our industry, people like Kent and Nepa promoted it. Other people who just had built big email lists full of hypnotists would promote it. And the thing was, if you're not, for anyone who's not familiar with the concept of affiliate marketing, they would tell their audience about it. It would all be tracked magically using technology, and then they would get paid 50%. So we went out, we did it. I said, I don't know how it's going to work. This was done in like the winter time after my last season, I think. So Alex came to my little flat, which was at the time was just outside Sheffield, which is where I was living at the time for a few years. And I put up a green screen that I'd bought. I had some like softbox lights, and we filmed him making some videos to sell the thing to sell it, like sales videos. Put them on the page, put it together. We did like a launch of it over 9 days. And it did, Alex would give you the exact number. I think it was about $260,000 in sales over the course of 9 days. And we went, bloody hell. So half of that immediately goes to the affiliates who promoted it. So that brings it down to about $130,000. PayPal actually closed the PayPal account because this PayPal account had gone from, this was a spare PayPal account he had. It went from selling nothing to $260,000 or $250,000 in 9 days. And they said, that's not possible. You're doing something illegal. And they closed the account down, and we just managed to pay the affiliates out. We were going to keep the money for 30 days because there's like a refund period. We're going to keep the money for 30 days, then pay the affiliates, and then we would take our half each, so 25% of the total each. And PayPal closed the account down. We managed to just pay the affiliates and get our money out in time because they sort of said, we're going to close this down in the next couple of days. And so I'd just made a quarter of the $260,000, and Alex had made a quarter of the $260,000 in effectively 9 days plus a couple of weeks of planning and preparation and pulling it all together. And I went, that's amazing. So let's keep going and do different things. So we turned it into like a monthly membership subscription, and that was running for a while, and all of that stuff was going really well. So obviously Alex has a sketchy sounding past in our industry. Some people love him, some people hate him. I'm on the side where I got on incredibly well with him. He made me a lot of money over time with his stuff. And honestly, Alex had a ton of opportunities to rip me off at any time and didn't. So I can't see anybody. This is not a defense of him at all. That's my opinion. So I continued working with him on the basis that everything was going well. I, somewhere along the way here, and we've missed this, but it's not important. I created a way of like a hypnotic induction to do in a show. And, Alex was impressed by it, and he said, can I buy the rights to teach that off you? Like, so I can teach it at my events and stuff. It'll always be yours, and I'll always say it's yours, and it will always have your name on it. But can I pay you a lump sum to be able to teach that at all of the events and stuff that I ever run? And as part of that, we'll put out a DVD about it. So I said, yeah, that's fine. And the next day I was in Rochdale where he lives. He went to the bank, withdrew a four-figure sum of cash, more than £1,000, came back and handed it to me and said, there you go, that's the rights to that done. So like, I can't ever say he did anything that was in any way scammy or dodgy while I worked with him. Wow. Anyway, so we're doing that. We had a great time. We went on. That business did well over a million quid in sales. And then eventually it got to a point where I was like, that was great. So I was doing that. Kennedy was doing the same sort of thing, selling his stuff online, just selling his own content. And we were both exchanging notes and saying, this works, that doesn't work, I tried this, I did a sales video, that worked, and that one didn't, I tried doing this. We both fell in love with email as a methodology of marketing. And so we both just exchanged loads of notes over time. And so then fast forward a really long time of being mates and both independently doing entertainment businesses and selling stuff on the internet businesses at the same time, we both just realized we could pool our resources. We had similar passions. We wanted to do stuff that was bigger than us. He was sort of fed up of selling the persuasion bit. I was ready to step back from selling the teaching hypnosis stuff. I've never wanted to be the guy who teaches hypnosis. I did a Penguin lecture in 2018 and I loved that. But I definitely didn't want my primary business outside of entertainment to be teaching other hypnotists.
Yeah.
So I decided to, I basically, Alex effectively bought me out of my half of that business, selling the hypnosis stuff, and I left. And he had everything he needed to keep running it by that point. And that was really it. So Kennedy and I formed our business. We started a software platform that led to us teaching email marketing. He was already teaching email marketing and still does to entertainers inside of his program. So it was just a really organic fit, really. So we teach what would happen if a hypnotist and a mind reader wanted to figure out how to get inside people's heads genuinely by email to use psychology-driven email marketing that makes sales. And so now we help small one-man, one-woman home businesses mostly. We've got clients who make and sell jewelry at home. We've got people who teach cooking for people with autism, like the most vast variety of stuff. People sell it on the internet. They probably fall into our world. So that's it. So we both knew that we wanted something that was bigger than us, so that if we got hit by a bus tomorrow, I can't go out and gig anymore while I'm sat in hospital with my foot up on a ramp and on a tube. And so we wanted something that was bigger than us. And you know what? We both live in a place of absolute gratitude. I'm incredibly grateful for that and that decision, because when the pandemic hit, we've got so many mutual friends who would have gone out and had to stop doing the thing they do for a living and they love and go and get the job that they never wanted to have through no fault of their own. It's just, there is no other choice. You've got to pay the bills. You've got to feed your family. And we were just so very, very lucky, very, very grateful that we had this other business. And because we were helping online businesses, and online businesses generally thrive through the pandemic, our business grew through the pandemic. Now we've got a business that we run really, really comfortably. It's great. We've got an amazing team. We've got a team of 9 now who work in that business. And then we still have all the flexibility and the freedom in the world. So the fact that I'm going to go and do a month at the Fringe, 23 days at the Fringe this year, and I did it in 2019, I did it last year as well. I can just say, are you guys all right to man the fort for a month? I'll be around. I'll be checking emails and Slack that we use to communicate and stuff, but I'll generally be busy flyering and socializing and doing my show every day. Is that all right? That's totally fine. If Kennedy wants to go off and do a ship, that's fine. I can man the fort while he's away. So we've just got a really good system. Everything's good. Everything's happy. And we've built the businesses to really sort of support each other. Plus the stuff that we've learned from doing our online stuff aids me in my ability to run ads to sell tickets to my show. Again, it's not a huge influx of tickets that way, but it definitely supports it. So yeah, everything kind of works really well together.
That's great. 2 questions on that. One, you say you're helping small to medium-sized businesses. If there's a magician listening to this and they go, you know what, I really relate to everything that Rob's talked about here. I want a second income. I want to be further along than I am right now. Is getting in touch with you a good thing for them to do?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing to do, we have a podcast called The Email Marketing Show. It's if email marketing was fun and interesting. And again, it's not aimed at entertainers in any stretch, but we do have a bunch of entertainers who listen to it just because people we know who sort of found out we're doing it and went and tuned in. And so that's a really good place to start. You'll find it wherever you find your podcasts, just The Email Marketing Show. You can look for that. But also, that's the best thing to do. And then if you figure out, do you know what, there's a thing that I could sell that I'm interested in and is related to what I already do. So maybe you produce your own tricks and you want to sell those better. We definitely help people with that kind of thing. As you'll know, Kennedy sold a ton of his stuff, like his book and his routines and stuff. Again, using the same techniques that we teach and sell. So as long as you've got something to sell, it's not a get rich quick scheme. You're not going to be buying into anything. As long as you've got something you could feasibly sell, listen to the podcast. It's totally free. And if it sounds like your kind of bag, then just do what we tell you in the podcast. You'll be able to get on our mailing list and then we'll sell you things.
Brilliant. That's great. The other question is, do you ever, like, you've just talked about how successful this business is that you do with Kennedy, 9 members of staff. I mean, that's absolutely incredible. Do you ever get yourself into a situation where you just think, you know what, I could sit at home and not go and do this gig and I would make twice as much money if I put that much effort into that business and I grew that business, but I could do it without having to jump on the road and do a 400-mile drive, whatever it may be? Or is the passion always there? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like,
yeah. So at the moment, I couldn't ever see myself stop gigging. And we had a conversation recently. It's part of the reason why our team grew to where it is, We were doing a lot of the manual stuff ourselves. So we would do like a webinar, and then we'd download the recording of the webinar from Zoom, we'd render it, we'd optimize it, we'd top and tail it, we'd upload it, put it in the members area. That was that. And it only takes half an hour, but it's half an hour of my time that I had to go and do, or his time. And I would say, why don't we stop doing that and get somebody else to do it? And it got to the point where we actually had a conversation, and I just said, if having this business, unless I become super famous, there is little chance that my performance business will ever make the same kind of money that this business does. But I can make a really good income just as a hypnotist. I can grow a business that's bigger than me with this other business. I said, I will come to resent this business if it gets in the way of me being able to do gigs and that kind of thing. So I couldn't ever see myself not wanting to perform. It's the level of buzz that's unequaled anywhere else. And to sort of bring a story full circle, when I was in Edinburgh in 2019, I'd never done the Fringe before. I'd gone up every year as a punter, but I'd never done it before. I did the Fringe, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, have you ever done cruise ships? And I said, no. So I work for Royal Caribbean. Here's my card. Send me a message. And Royal Caribbean sends scouts over to the Edinburgh Fringe this year now. And so I waited, you know, like when you've been on a first date and you're not sure how long you should wait before you send somebody a text message. I waited about 10 minutes before I sent this woman an email. Like, I went straight up to Fringe HQ, found Wi-Fi, sent her an email. And she said, I'll be back in Miami next week and I'll get back in touch with you then. So she did. And we booked in two. She said, basically, we'll put you out. We'll negotiate the whole deal. She said, we'll put you out. We'll do two sort of test runs. As long as the audience feedback's good, then we can take you on full time. Sadly, those two trips were booked in to do somewhere in Italy to somewhere else in Italy, and from Amsterdam to Tallinn in Estonia. And just before they happened, the pandemic happened, everything ground to a halt and never came about. But I'm still in touch with them all the time. We're looking, as soon as sort of close contact acts are allowed to be back on ships, I'll do those two test runs and give that a blast, seeing as I never pursued it when I was originally going to. So there's like lots of stuff still in the air and pipeline stuff. So yeah, I don't think I could ever give up performing, unless there'll be that one sad day when I'm just too old to do it now and I'll want to retire before I'm too dusty and crusty. But apart from that, I just couldn't give it up. I need the attention too badly, I think.
I get it. I totally get it. I completely get it, 100%. One last question before we finish this whole thing off. The final question is, what's next? What have you got left on your bucket list that you want to achieve? What goal? Because you are a very driven entrepreneurial type of person. You really are. You've got this business that you do with Kennedy. You've got your own business as a performer, which is really taking off. You've talked to us, you know, with the cruises and with the theatres and with your other work that you do. I mean, you are incredibly successful. Is there anything else that you're wanting to do? I mean, is there another business you're wanting to set up? I mean, we talked off camera about something else that you're doing with Kennedy, which is completely unrelated to that business. I mean, is there other aspects and things that you want to achieve, and or are you just, yeah, tell that. That's the last question. Where are you going from here?
A few years ago, my aim was to try and get on telly, and effectively I would love to do hypnosis. It's sort of died out somewhat in this country, like getting audiences. A lot of younger audiences have never even seen a hypnotist before. They don't know that when they get there, there's going to be a line of chairs. People are going to get up, get hypnotized, do funny things. Like, don't really know what it is. From doing the theatre shows, I came to realize that that's a thing. And so I have to create some sort of education in the world, the wider UK, about what a hypnosis show is for the younger generations. But so I used to want to get on telly and sort of do what Darren did for mind reading, for hypnotism. Because obviously, I think, you know, before Darren started, if somebody said they're a mentalist or a mind reader, I don't think people would have flocked to see it. But Darren made it very cool, very accessible, very interesting. And suddenly people flocked to see it. Magic's never really had that problem. Obviously Paul Daniels was doing it, and then Dynamo came along, very different style, but like magic didn't die off in the meantime, and hypnosis sort of has. If you'd asked me that a few years ago, the answer would have been, I want to be on TV, because that's how I'm going to get an audience. For me now, I really want to nail social media. So I think if you look at all the people who are nailing social media, you've talked to some of them on this channel. I think if you look at the people who are nailing Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, that kind of thing, I want to do what those magicians are doing with hypnosis. So that's one big goal and something that we're working on now. And then just really scale the theatre show. I would love to be, I was watching an interview with Jimmy Carr, who I've got a huge amount of respect for. And he was talking about the fact that when he started out as a comedian, he was like known as the hardest working comedian in the country because he was going out maybe for 25, 30 quid a night, but he was doing 300 shows a year. And I was like, and now he was talking in this interview, was being interviewed by two other comedians who were doing small tours, sort of bigger than what I'm doing, but small tours. And he was saying, so why are you only doing 30 shows? Why aren't you doing 300 shows? Like, why don't you just keep going? Just keep going and keep going and keep going. As soon as you get to the end, start again and go back around the circuit if you have to. And that sort of stuck with me. And I'm really keen. The big goal for me is to, as much as I'm enjoying the tour bit, I really want to be able to do 3, 4, 5 nights in a city and then, or a town, and then move on and do the next one rather than one night pack up, move on, one night move on, pack up. So that's really the goal, is just to keep doing what I'm doing, keep refining it, keep learning more, growing the audience. Every time I do the show, we get people who come back and bring new people. So that's good. It's got a sort of virality to it. It takes a long time, but it's got a virality to it. So working on that, that's really it. And then just keep growing what I'm doing, really.
Based on what you've said there, would you consider, and I'm going to throw those three letters out, would you consider BGT? I mean, I've never seen a hypnotist on BGT, and I know how great you are.
And yeah, the way that
they approach things is very different now. You know, I mean, I remember back in the day where they used to take the mick out of acts, and they don't do that anymore. And, you know, if your desire is to have more people know you, and but your social media will blow up if you went and did a good job on BGT. And with people like Russ Stevens being involved, now and obviously Russ knows you from back in the day and knows how good you are. I mean, that
so I'm having the conversation, and I haven't yet, and I haven't yet decided.
Okay, because there are risks, I imagine, as well.
Yeah, it's one of those things. Obviously it's a slightly awkward medium. There's some interesting TV rules about the fact I would have to hypnotize people in advance, and then like show a little montage of that happening as part of my little snippet act. There's some rules about whether that's allowed within a TV competition or whether that's considered an unfair advantage. In the same way, magicians aren't allowed to use pre-show on the UK show and that kind of thing, because it's considered an unfair advantage over a singer who doesn't have to. I don't know why, because they don't have to do pre-show. So it's not an unfair advantage in my opinion, but there's some rules to look at around that. So I started just before the pandemic. And then the pandemic happened. There wasn't a series last year, so we'll see.
Well, if you do it, I would be the first person at the front cheering you on. Seriously,
thanks, man. I appreciate that.
You know, if your goal is to, you know, be the Derren Brown of hypnotism, that would be a good way, I imagine, to kind of get into that.
Yeah, we'll see. What maybe? Watch this space.
You know what, Rob? This has been an incredible interview. Where can people connect with you on socials, and can you tell us more? So obviously you've got the podcast, so it's remind me the name again,
the email marketing show, yeah,
and that's with you and Kennedy. But where can people check you out on social media and, you know, everything else?
Best thing to do probably is just follow me on Instagram. It's just Robert Temple Hypnotist. I'm super approachable. If you send me a DM, I'll reply. I get DMs from magicians and hypnotists who've seen my Penguin Lecture a lot. Penguin Lecture's been really well received. So if you happen to be interested in learning hypnosis and that kind of thing, it's 3.5 hours long or something ridiculous. There's an hour. The first hour is me doing a show at the Penguin Studio. And then you get to watch me teach it, and then the Q&A with Dan Harlan. So that's worth watching, digging out on the Penguin website. Again, the reviews have been, I was a bit nervous about it, but the reviews have been great. So that's good. And yeah, that's really it. Instagram, Robert Temple Hypnotist, is probably the best place to go.
And if people want to speak to you and Kennedy, do you have a website that they can go to regarding the
other stuff? Yeah, it's emailmarketingheroes.com.
emailmarketingheroes.com. That's fantastic. Rob, this has been an incredible interview. I want everybody who's listened to this to connect with you, and please leave a comment below. You will obviously read them. One more time, seriously, thank you so much.
Thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Guys, leave a comment, drop a comment down below. I'll be back again tomorrow with another video. But once again, Rob, thank you so much, my friend. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to the Talk Magic Podcast. Magic. Be sure to like and subscribe to the Magic TV YouTube channel, Magic TV, which includes 14 unique videos every week. Whatever type of magic you're interested in, we've got you covered. Just search YouTube for Craig Petty's Magic TV or click on the link in the description from this podcast below. Be sure to join us next Friday at 5 p.m. right here for another Talk Magic podcast.